administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak. But then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the camera,
they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, you wanted to quickly add
to that? I think what also means is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale, of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, Muslim, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on in this fight.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black community.
No, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch sticker on there. Got some walkie-talkies. It's two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one of my wife. The cops don't come in Canfield like no more, like doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera, that's my weapon, and the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
An endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is valuable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And, of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on the community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. New technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take a brief break now from a discussion. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and it's on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver equitable justice for people who've suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. But then every investigation into every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to everywhere. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you were saying, it's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's that system that's carried on.
People are
just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man-in-chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African-Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this is.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lou. Thank you to both my guests and to you, Aydin Kamila Shambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on March 21st, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Nowruz. The ways to confront sanctions, either begging the sanctioner or achieving domestic forces and production inside the country.
We could take two approaches in confronting the sanctions. One is to go to the sanctioner, begging him to decrease or lift the sanctions that he has imposed on us. Then he will say, "All right, you have to do this and that," a bunch of arrogant demands, and then I will lift some of them. This is one path, which is in fact the path of humiliation, destruction, and retrogression. Another approach is to activate our domestic forces. We have good capabilities. We should activate these forces so as to manufacture the products on which sanctions have been imposed. When the other side sees that such products are being manufactured inside our country, he himself will get moving because he wants to profit from the product on the market in other countries. This is one of the main sources of profits for governments. As a result of this, the sanctions will either be automatically lifted or rendered ineffectual.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever wanna be. My Lord, protect me from this honor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Our nation has chosen the second path. This is really the case. I see that our dear nation has chosen the second path and has made great achievements. The last one being the achievements related to the coronavirus. If you remember, in the beginning of the spread of the coronavirus, we did not even have masks. We did not have enough resources to produce masks in the country. The same was true of disinfectants. However, a national endeavor was made and as a result, we became self-sufficient in producing masks. Others would steal masks This occurred in Isfand of 1398 according to the solar calendar and Farvardin of 1399. A European country bought masks from China, but other European countries snatched it away in the middle of the transportation. There was such a shortage of masks. Well, we produced them on our own. Our youth and our people produced masks and disinfectants at home and at mosque. It was really a manifestation of cutting the dependence on foreign countries. And we continued to move forward until we faced the challenge to produce a vaccine.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The Iran nuclear talks have begun in Vienna. After the first day, the talks were hailed as useful. The negotiations are proving to be delicate, and risks are actually going in either direction. Iran has said that it won't accept the division of U.S. sanctions into JCPOA-related and non-related ones. Will the U.S. heed to what will be a key turner that would end the standoff, and that is the removal of all sanctions? Even the U.S. Iran's envoy, Rob Malley, has said that the U.S. maximum pressure campaign has failed.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, completed their first round of talks in the Austrian capital on Tuesday under the framework of the Joint Commission with the aim of reviving the accord. The U.S. also sent a delegation to Vienna, but Iran rejected to hold direct or indirect talks with it. Tehran and the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden remain in a standoff as both sides call on the other to take the first step to return to its deal-related commitments. Iran says since the U.S. unilaterally left the accord in 2018, it must first fulfill the obligation by removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner. Following the Vienna talks, Iran's top negotiator and deputy foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, highlighted Tehran's stance on returning to compliance with the pact.
We only go back to full compliance when the U.S. has lifted all sanctions imposed or relabeled after January 2017 and has verified by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then we would go for full compliance.
The foreign ministry spokesman also stressed that the Islamic Republic is opposed to a step-by-step return to the JCPOA.
It does not require any talks or actually step-for-step plan. We have done just one step, and this is removal of all sanctions imposed illegally against the Iranian nation.
A senior Iranian official told Press TV that Tehran would not accept a division of the Trump-era sanctions into JCPOA-related ones and those unrelated to the deal, stressing that all of them must be removed. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Robert Malley, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, have already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign launched by the previous administration yielded no results. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani also said the failure of such campaign pushed the Biden administration to send this delegation to Vienna. Now, Iran and JCPOA's remaining parties are preparing to continue their talks on Friday, but Tehran has made it clear that it will end the talks if found a lack of progress. While the world is desperately waiting for the outcome of the meeting, Iran says the ball is now in the U.S. court to show whether it's serious enough in its promise to salvage the JCPOA.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, Fouad Azadi, is a university professor and political analyst who joins us. And from London, we have Saeed Mohsen Abbas, who's a journalist and political commentator. I'd like to welcome you both. Fouad Azadi, let me first start with you. This is the latest that has come out regarding the talks. Iran has said, and this is a mouthful, that the only U.S. path back to the JCPOA is effective removal of all imposed, reimposed, and relabeled sanctions. So if you can break that open for us and explain to us what Iran is saying.
When Trump came into office, he introduced new sanctions on Iran that were in violation of JCPOA. So what Iran is saying is that if the United States wants to go back to the nuclear agreement, the U.S. needs to remove all Trump-era sanctions. Another issue that happened was that the U.S. the government, meaning the Trump administration, went back to old sanctions during the Obama administration, during the Bush administration, and reintroduced these old sanctions. So Iran is saying those old sanctions, the reintroduced sanctions, should also be removed. And then a third thing that happened during the Trump administration was that they relabeled some sanctions that were not related to Iran's nuclear program. So in order to make the Biden administration's job difficult in removing sanctions, they put terrorism-related sanctions or other non-nuclear-related sanctions on nuclear-related sanctions. So if Iran and the United States reached an agreement on returning to JCPOA, those sanctions cannot be removed because they have other labels. So relabeling basically means that. So what Iran is saying is that the damage that was done during the Trump administration in different ways all need to be corrected. Iran is not going to play this game of cat and mouse, of just playing with sanctions on the other side and Iran doing what Iran is supposed to do under the nuclear agreement. So this time, given the fact that we experienced the period between 2015 and 2021, Iran needs to make sure that the sanctions are actually removed, not just on the papers, but in reality, in practice. And that's what Iran is saying.
Well, Saeed Mohsen Abbas, this is a new, it seems like a new development in terms of sanctions. I mean, from Iran's point of view, all American sanctions, including the Obama-era sanctions, the sanctions restored by Trump, and the additional sanctions in the Trump era labeled as non-nuclear, they have to be terminated. But it seems like the U.S. is actually trying to divide these sanctions saying these could be removed and these may not be removed. I'm not too sure, again, what type of sanction relief, if you want to call it, the U.S. is trying to impose on Iran. Iran, of course, is against it. Why would the U.S. use that kind of tactic, in a sense, when it knows Iran should, it should know that Iran is smarter than that, to fall for that?
I think you have to see it from the point of view of the context of American imperialism globally. The fact is that Iran knows that the U.S. is overstretched globally. It knows that the U.S. has economic and social problems at home, medical challenges with the COVID. It knows that America's proxies, Saudi Arabia, etc., have failed in terms of their ability to negate Iran's geopolitical defense of its interests in its own backyard. They know that none of this is going to change. They also know that the maximum pressure which Donald Trump imposed has failed. So there's a lot of weaknesses there, which America is now desperately trying to work out how they can cover up. So, for instance, Biden now, is he just buying time? Is he looking for ways of stalling Iran? I rather suspect so. I mean, if he doesn't go for what the Islamic Republic of Iran has proposed, and it's a very, very realistic and very sober and very calculated response that they've given, they say put it on the table, withdraw all of the sanctions, zero sanctions, because they're all illegal, internationally speaking. So get rid of those, and then we can go back to talking about what Iran needs to do to comply to the JCPOA. If that doesn't happen, Iran is saying basically, we don't trust you. We've seen you walk out of an agreement just like that before. We have no guarantee that you will do that again. We need to see real results on the table before we can take you seriously.
Okay, Fouad Azadi, I do have to apologize, actually. I should ask this question that I'm going to ask you now before I ask you the previous question, and that is, well, we've had 2 days of talks at this point. I'm sure you're in the know about all the developments out of these 2 days, in your capacity especially. How do you think things are going? I mean, how do you think that the other side, which includes the U.S., has represented itself, are things moving somewhat in the right direction or not?
You know, it's a decision that the U.S. government, the Biden administration, has to take. They can either follow Trump's failed policies of the past, continue the maximum pressure campaign with another label, and fail the same way that Trump failed, or they can realize that dealing with Iran in this manner is going to get them nowhere. It's a decision they have to make. It seems what the Biden administration wants to do is to prolong these talks for different reasons. For example, since they like to keep sanctions, if they manage to just talk and talk and talk, then they can keep and keep and keep sanctions. They have, the Biden administration has difficulties with U.S. Congress. You have a good number of senators that are opposed to JCPOA. Same thing is true in the House of Representatives. So again, if they have this prolonged period of talk and no action, then they don't have to worry about Congress getting upset with them, given the fact that the Biden administration has domestic issues they need to deal with. Similar is true with regard to pressures from the Zionist government, from the Saudis. Just making these talks go longer than what they should be is also pleasing to these allies that the United States has. And I think at least some people in the Biden administration are interested to affect Iran's presidential election. And if these talks continue and result in small bits of, for example, releasing some money that Iran has in international banks, that could affect Iran's domestic politics as well. So I think that's the plan that the U.S. has to make this, so not to reach anything concrete, but to prolong these type of discussions. And I think a lot of people in Iran are realizing this, and I don't think the Iranian government officials are going to go and accept that type of tactic.
Well, Seymour Sinabas, one of the things that has come out that's a development out of this is the issue of verification.
Now, Tehran's resumption of its commitments, which it had scaled back, retaliation for Washington's exit from the deal, Iran has said is not going to be possible until after a reasonable time is given in order for Iran to verify that the sanctions have been removed. That almost gives the impression that Iran is saying that the U.S. is putting it under pressure in order for Iran to make a decision on that. Do you think the U.S. is in a position to posture itself that way, this putting pressure on Iran, in this case, for the removal of sanctions, for Iran to make sure that, that it's actually happening?
No, I don't think it's in a position to do that. It's really, again, a nonsense kind of game which the Biden administration is playing. I agree totally with my my colleague that they are definitely looking to elongate this this sense that they might do something, so that in the Iranian public or within the domestic Iranian affairs, there's a confusion amongst people as to whether they should rush into a deal which would for sure give them initial respite in terms of the economic atrocities and the terrorism that's been inflicted on the Iranian people, which is being inflicted, let's face it, primarily because the Americans want regime change. They want to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran's government, its way of governing, its entire strategy and policy in the region. That is still there, and the Zionist regime's primary objective regarding any dealing with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And I don't think the Iranian public nor the politicians should forget that that is still their overriding concern. It's nothing to do with necessarily even the nuclear power, etc. It's all to do with bringing down the Iranian establishment and making it compliant to World Bank, compliant to Central Bank, compliant to the American military industrial arms complex, compliant to the money mafias that run America. This is what is the real objective. And I think that Ayatollah Khamenei has made it very clear that he's very, very aware of this agenda. And therefore, you see the stance that has come out. It's been something which Grand Ayatollah Khamenei himself said several times over the last month, as far as I could see, that the only way we're going to take anything seriously is if, first of all, Americans show the seriousness of their intent by withdrawing all of these sanctions. Now, the other thing which is really causing the Americans, should cause the Americans to have food for thought, is that China has just completed a deal worth $400 billion plus, in which they're willing to develop infrastructure within Iran, and Iran in return will do all sorts of trade deals, particularly around oil, etc. This should send a signal to the Americans that they no longer rule the roost in West Asia, and there are alternatives for nations like the Islamic Republic of Iran, who want to maintain their sovereignty and their integrity, their independence, which is basically to do business eastwards, whether it's to do with Russia or to do with China. This is a doorway now which the Americans need to take seriously, because if they don't act in a reasonable way with independent sovereign nations of that region, like even Iraq, Iran, Syria, and the like, then the fact is there are alternative ways for economic sustainability to be achieved. Yes, it'll take a little longer, and it wouldn't be an immediate cash-in, but over the long term, that might be the far better route for Iran to take, economically speaking, because it would be a far stronger deal. Let the Americans back in, let the central bank in, back in, let the money mafia that runs that show back into Iran, and what you're going to get is the same thing you had under the Shah. A few people will get very rich, but largely what will happen is Iran's wealth will be mined and sent back to the same transnational corporations and bodies that were milking it for many, many years under the Shah. So I think the Iranians have got a lot to gain from patience and having a longer-term view of the way they do their deals. And JCPOA isn't the be-all and end-all for making Iran what I would consider to be a great nation.
Professor Izadi, I'm curious as to what you think about Rob Malley. Now, he has said that Iran's elections in June are not a factor in the Biden administration's decision-making for how to proceed with the nuclear talks, and he has also made it clear he thinks, in terms of, I'm not sure if he represents the U.S. side in its entirety, but he has said that Iran's reaction to one of his statements, very promising, to the statements Mali has made, that the U.S. knows that in order to get back into compliance, it's going to have to remove the sanctions, that the sanctions are inconsistent with the 2015 deal. What do you think? What's your reaction to the statement that he's made there?
Well, he's stating something that's very obvious. Iran is not going to change its nuclear policy as long as Trump-era sanctions and other sanctions are in place. So he's basically stating a fact. Rob Malley also knows that Iran has the experience of JCPOA negotiations. So trusting the U.S. side is going to be an option that's not going to be available for Iran, given the experience that Iran has. So as Iran representative, he needs to say things to invite Iranian officials and also the general public in Iran that follows this type of news to encourage them to go back to the nuclear agreement, because after all, the nuclear agreement puts severe restriction on Iran's nuclear program, and that's something that the United States is interested in. But this type of statements need to be followed by action. And as long as U.S. officials talk about, use this terminology of longer and stronger, I think they're not going in the right direction. By longer, they mean they want to change the JCPOA. There are some sunset clauses that they like to extend, make it longer. And by stronger, they want to include other things, like Iran's missiles program and Iran's regional policy, and negotiate on those issues. And Iranian government leaders have said that they're not available to do that. Iran's foreign policy and Iran's defense policy are not going to be dictated from outside. So it's going to be quite complicated. And sooner or later, the Biden administration needs to decide whether they want to follow the old policies or change the failed policies and start a new page and learn from their past mistakes.
Well, we have had a reaction to Seymour and Abbas just in the past minutes regarding the talks in which Israel has come out saying, the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who still has his job, saying that Israel would not be bound to a nuclear deal between world powers and Iran. His reasoning, if that would enable the Islamic Republic to develop nuclear weapons, because he says there's one thing that compels us to prevent those who seek our extermination from carrying out their plot. First of all, Iran has always put aside that notion. It's never been part of its program. But the mere fact that he says that almost implies that it's going against the U.S., not to mention the other world powers, that since they are involved in the talks, of course the U.S. not involved in the talks directly, that by default that would mean they're after Israel's extermination based on how Israel is wording it. Why is Israel even a factor in this?
Well, I'm glad Israel's piped up, because most of what the Americans have been doing has been Israel in the puppeteering Americans in the background. So it's interesting that they're having to be more vocal and come into this issue, because they're the ones who are primarily responsible for the destruction of the JCPOA deal and for really ultimately getting the Americans to pull out. Netanyahu went on a massive campaign to derail any agreement that was in place. And of course, Israel, yes, let's talk about nuclear weapons. Israel has 400 of them plus. That's confirmed reports that we have. They've also just begun digging a much deeper set of installations for their nuclear production in Damar. I think I'm not sure exactly what the name of the place is, but I've certainly picked up that this week there's been a huge increase in their own nuclear capacity building. They are not subject to any nuclear proliferation treaty restrictions or even the scrutiny of the international atomic agencies. Why not? Why is Israel not being brought to book or to task by by the rest of the world. And yet it can squeak and pipe up on Iran, which has no nuclear weapons, does not have the capacity to make those nuclear weapons, and yet its word seems to carry plenty of weight amongst the, what I call, the Zio-Western imperialist powers. So this hypocrisy, this double standard, this this sense of saying that it's okay that Israel, which has a clear hatred since day one of the Islamic Republic, or Iran's new establishment, gets no scrutiny, is not regarded as a threat, an existential threat to the Islamic Republic of Iran or to its neighbors, which it interferes regularly with, balkanizes the region, and is the key disruptive force in that entire region. Yet Iran, Israel wants Iran to be put under scrutiny. Well, let's put them under scrutiny. Let's also put under the table de-escalation of the U.S. imperialism in that region.
Thank you. I'm sorry to have jumped in there. We're just fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, Fouad Azadi, University professor, political analyst. Thank you. And Said Mohsen Abbas, their journalist and political commentator. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Ratavlay and the team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
What is happening at the Amazon-Cerrado boundary may be a precursor for feverish tropical forests across the world. Unlike humans, these forests won't have air conditioners or sunscreens to protect them, says Malavika Wiar, writer, in an article published under the heading Study Sounds Latest Warning of Rainforest Turning into Savanna as Climate Warms. Here's more. As the planet warms, it isn't just humans who are feeling the heat. Trees are too. Rising temperatures are disrupting a primary engine of life on Earth, photosynthesis. The disproportionate warming in the Cerrado Belt is driven not just by global temperature rise, but also by local deforestation and fragmentation of wooded areas, as pasture land and croplands have eaten away into forests. Their cooling effect is becoming muted. A recent study from Brazil adds to fears that climate change is altering the face of the planet. Literally, tropical forests could look more and more like forests or savannas in the future, according to the research base in Brazil's Cerrado biome. This ecoregion, adjacent to the Amazon forest, is where savanna, grasslands, and forests mingle. The paper published in Environmental Research Letters in March focused on four trees species found in both the Amazonian tropical forest and savanna land. Colla parviflora, known as Poterra in Portuguese, Pseudobombax longiflorum, or the Brazilian shaving brush tree, Hymenia stegocarpa, and Vatiara macrocarpa, also known as angulim. The article extends present knowledge of heat tolerance to tropical species, in particularly hot regions, testing species not tested before, said Gotthard Heinrich Kraus, professor of plant physiology at Heinrich Heine University, Germany. Kraus, who has not involved with the study, noted that the paper underlines how increased number of extreme heat waves, often combined with drought stress, compound the heat stress faced by trees. The maximum temperatures in Cerrado region and the neighboring forests can reach 45 degrees Celsius. The area has warmed in recent decades, and heat waves that regularly sweep the region are becoming hotter and drier. A leaf warmth depends on how much solar radiation it absorbs and what it losses through conduction and as long wave radiation. Leaves facing the harsh tropical sun heat up faster than the ambient air around them. Prolonged exposure to heat can induce damage to leaf tissue, compromising photosynthetic efficiency and consequently tree's fitness, said Igor Arajo, first author of the new paper and an ecologist at Mato Grosso State University, Brazil. The disproportionate warming in the Cerrado Belt is driven not just by global temperature rise, but also by local deforestation and fragmentation of wooded areas. As pasture land and cropland have eaten away into forests, their cooling effect is becoming muted. Trees cool themselves and areas around them by transpiring water through the stoma dotting their leaf surfaces. This process, along with evaporation, is also why forested areas induce rainfall. One single adult tree in the Amazon can transpire up to 1,000 L, that is 264 gallons of water per day, functioning as a natural air conditioner of the environment. This process is called biotic pump, which is reduced by deforestation, Arajo said. When faced with scorching heat and dry spells, the pores on leaves clamp shut to conserve water. This will reduce or prevent transpirational cooling of leaves, causing substantial increases of leaf temperature above air temperature, Cross said. The study estimated for the first time what temperatures leaves can tolerate. To do this, the authors calculated the temperature at which a critical component of the photosystem breaks down and the temperatures that leaves are experiencing. The difference between the two levels is called the thermal safety margin, TSM. Cross said he expected that the temperature at which scientists observe permanent damage to leaf tissue to be higher than what the researchers estimate. This would mean a wider safety net, but it still would not be enough to protect most species considered in the research given the current pace of warming. It's not just tree health that declines. Other scientists have shown that heat stress also affects carbon dioxide uptake by trees. According to Cross, there is a reduction in the CO2 absorbed by plants even at temperatures lower than those that short-circuit photosynthesis. Such a hostile environment is dangerous for leaves and trees. The tree is not shedding leaves as part of a seasonal cycle, but rather because they're not performing their function and harnessing energy. The authors found that in some species, the maximum leaf temperatures are already exceeding this threshold. But if average temperatures rise by even 2.5 degrees Celsius, this will be true for most trees species, they estimate. With a 5 degrees Celsius rise, all tree species studied will suffer from leaf burn. It's not just tree health that declines. Other scientists have shown that heat stress also affects carbon dioxide uptake by trees. According to Cross, there is a reduction in CO2 absorbed by plants even at temperatures lower than those that short-circuit photosynthesis. Such reduction will contribute to the reduction in carbon sink of the tropical forest, he said. At the moment, savanna species adapted to higher temperatures are doing better than the rainforest species. Our results thus indicate expected shifts in the future and thus a trend toward savanna vegetation replacing forest in the regions in southern Amazonia characterized by large patches of deforestation, the authors wrote. What is happening at the Amazon-Cerrado boundary may be a precursor for feverish tropical forests across the world. Unlike humans, these forests won't have air conditioners or sunscreens to protect them.